the old church smells of spilled wine, American sweat, and recently burned cordite. But these are raw, newer intrusions that haven't done away with the prevailing Catholic odor, incense, wax, centuries of mild bleating from the lips of the flock. Children come in and go out, bringing furs and taking them away, chatting with Ludwig and presently inviting him along to check out the freight cars down at the marshalling yards. There are about 30 kids on Chicklets' payroll. My dream, he admits, is to bring all these kids back to America, out to Hollywood. I think there's a future for them in pictures. You heard of Cecil B. DeMille, the producer? My brother-in-law is pretty close to him. I think I can teach them to sing or something, a children's chorus, negotiate a package deal with DeMille. He can use them for the real big numbers, religious scenes, orgy scenes. Ha! Cries Marvy, dribbling champagne, eyeballs bulging. You're dreaming, all right, old buddy. You sell those kids to Cecil B. DeMille, it's for damn sure they ain't gonna be singing. He'll use them little suckers for galley slaves. Yeah, yeah, they'll be chained to the oars, just hauling ass, rowing old Henry Wilcoxen away into the sunset to fight them Greeks or Persians or somebody. Galley slaves, Chicklets roars. Never, by God, for DeMille, young fur henchmen can't be rowing. Out at the edge of town are the remains of an A4 battery, left where it stood as the troops fled south trying to escape British and Russian pincers. Marvy and Chicklets are going to have a look, and Slothrop is welcome to come along, but first there is the matter of Duane Marvy's atomic chili, which turns out to be a test of manhood. The champagne bottle is there within easy reach, but drinking from it will be taken as a sign of weakness. Once Slothrop would have been suckered in, but now he doesn't even have to think it over. While the two Americans, blinded, noses on fire and leaking incredible quantities of snot, undergo what the authoritative A Cheapskate's Guide to the Zone aptly describes as a Götterdämmerung of the mucous membranes, Slothrop sits guzzling champagne like soda pop, nodding, smiling, and mumbling, da, da, now and then for authenticity's sake. They ride out to the site in a green, grinning Ford staff car. Marvy, soon as he slides behind the wheel, turns into a fanged dipsomaniac, leaving rubber enough to condom a division. 0 to 70 before the echoes died, trying to run down bicyclists right and left, stampeding the livestock whilst bloody Chicklets, whooping happily, a champagne bottle in each fist, urges him on, Marvy bellowing, San Antonio Rose, his favorite song, Chicklets screaming out the window, admonitions like, fuck not with the kid, lest instead of fuck her, thou become fucky, which takes a while and draws only a few bewildered fascist salutes from old ladies and little children at the roadside. The site is a charred patch becoming green with new weeds, inside a copse of beech and some alder. Camouflaged metal stands silent across a ghostly crowd of late dandelions, gray heads nodding together waiting for the luminous wind that will break them toward the sea over to Denmark, out to all points of the zone. Everything's been stripped. The vehicles are back to the hollow design envelopes of their earliest specs, though there's still a faint odor of petrol and grease. Forget-me-nots are growing violent blue, violent yellow among the snarl of cables and hoses. Swallows have built a nest inside the control car, and a spider has begun filling in the web of the Meilerwagen boom with her own. Shit, says Major Marvy. Fucking Ruskies done stole everything. No offense, comrade. They go kicking through green and purple weeds, rusted food tins, old sawdust and chips of wood, surveying stakes, each with a tatter of white nailed on top, still chain away toward the guide beam transmitter 12 kilometers away, eastward. So it must have been the Russians they were trying to stop. Red, white, and blue winks from the dusty deck of the control car. Slothrop drops to one knee. The Schwarzkommando Mandala, K-E-Z-V-H. He looks up to see Marvy giving him a sly, fat smile. Why, sure, I should have known. You don't have no insignia on, she. You're like the Soviet CIC, ain't you? Slothrop stares back. Hey, who are you trying to get, huh? The smile vanishes. Say, I sure hope it ain't Colonel Chicherny now. He's a good Ruski, you know. I assure you, holding up the mandala crossed to vampire, my only interest is in dealing with the problem of these black devils. Back comes the smile, along with a fat hand on Slothrop's arm. You all set to go round and round with them when your comrades get here?
Round and round? I am not sure that I...
You know? Come on. Why, all them boogies that's camped outside of town. Hey, Ivan, goddamn, that's gonna be fun. I spent all day today cleaning my colts. caressing the sidearm in its holster. Go make me a coonskin cap out of one of them suckers, and I don't have to tell you what part's going to be dangling down there and back, do I, huh?
Which tickled Bloody Ticklet so much he liked to chokes laughing.
Actually, Sothrop, making it up as he goes along, my mission is coordinating intelligence,
whatever that means.
In operations such as this, I am down here, in fact, to reconnoiter the enemy position.
Enemy's right, Ticklets nods. They got guns and everything. Only thing a coon ought to have in his hands is a broom.
Marvy is frowning.
You ain't expecting us to go out there with you now. We can tell you how to get there, comrade, but you're crazy to go out there alone.
Why don't you wait till tonight? Scheduled to start about midnight, ain't it? You can wait till then.
It is essential that I gather certain information in advance.
Poker face.
Good. I do not have to tell you how important this is. A pregnant Lugosi pause. To all of us.
Well, that gets him directions out to the Schwarzkommando and a lift back into town, where the businessmen pick up a couple of those eager fräuleins and go roistering off into the sunset. Fothrop stands in their exhaust, muttering. Next time there won't be any custard pie, you asshole.
Takes him an hour to get out to the camp on foot across a wide meadow whose color is deepening now as if green dye flowed and seeped into its nap. He is aware of each single grass blade's shadow reaching into the shadows east of it. Pure milk-colored light sweeps up in a bell curve above the sun nearly down, transparent white flesh, fading up through many blues, powdery to dark steel at the zenith. Why is he out here doing this? Is this Ursula the Lemming's idea, too? Getting mixed up in other people's private feuds when he was supposed to be... whatever it was? Yeah, what happened to the Imipolex G, or that Yamf A.N., that Eskeret, supposed to be a hard-boiled private eye here, gonna go out all alone and beat the odds, avenge my friend that they killed, get my ID back, and just find that piece of mystery hardware, but now, it's just like looking for a needle in a haystack. Searching for something full of moonbeams. Something got to have you.
Feet whispering through weeds and meadow grass, humming along exactly the breathless, chin-up way Fred Astaire did, reflecting on his chances of ever finding Ginger Rogers again this side of their graceful mortality. Then, snapping back, no, wait, you're supposed to be planning soberly now, weighing your options, determining your goals at this critical turning point in your... Ya-ta-ta, looking for a needle in a... No, come on, Jackson, quit fooling, you've got to concentrate. The Eskeret now. Okay, if I can find that Eskeret and how Yamf was hooked in, if I can find that out, yeah, Imipolex now. Searching for a cellar full of saffron. Oh. But about which point, as if someone's simple longing has made it appear, comes a single needle stroke through the sky, the first star. Let me be able to warn them in time. They jump Slothrop among the trees, lean, bearded, black. They bring him into the fires where someone is playing a thumb harp whose sound box is carved from a piece of German pine whose reeds are cut from springs of a wrecked Volkswagen. Women in white cotton skirts printed with dark blue flowers, white blouses, braided aprons and black kerchiefs are busy with pots and tinware. Some are wearing ostrich eggshell necklaces, knife hatched in red and blue. A great cut of beef drips from a wooden spit over a fire. Enzian isn't there, but Andreas Orukambe is. Nervous as wire, wearing a navy pullover and army fatigue trousers. He remembers Slothrop.
Was ist los?
Slothrop tells him.
Supposed to be here at midnight. Don't know how many there are, but maybe you'd better clear out.
Maybe. Andreas is smiling. Have you eaten? The argument, go or stay, proceeds over supper. It is not the tactical decision-making Slothrop was taught in officer school. There seem to be other considerations, something the Zone Hereros know about and Slothrop doesn't.
We have to go where we go,
Andreas explains to him later, where Mukuru wants us to go.
Oh,
I thought you were out here looking for something like everybody else. The 00000. What about that?
That is Mukuru's.
He hides it where he wants us to seek. Look, I have a line on that Eskeret. He gives them Greta Erdmann's story. The heath, the gasoline works, the name, Blisero. That rings a bell. A gong, in fact. Everybody looks at everybody else. Now, Andreas, very careful. That was the name of the German who commanded the battery that used the Eskeret.
I don't know if they used it. Lucero took the woman to a factory where it was either put together or a part of it was made from some plastic called Imipolex G.
And she didn't say where?
Only the heath. See if you can find her husband, Miklos Tanats. He may have seen the actual firing, if there was one. Something out of the ordinary went on about then, but I never got to find out what.
Thank you.
It's okay. Maybe you can tell me something now. He brings out the mandala he found. What's it mean?
Andreas sets it on the ground, turns it till the K points northwest.
Klar,
touching each letter.
And Lüftung. These are the female letters, north letters.
In our villages, the women lived in huts on the northern half of the circle, the men on the south. The village itself was a mandala.
Klar is fertilization and birth, and Lüftung is the breath, the soul. Zündung and Vorstufe are the male signs, the activities, fire and preparation or building. And in the center, here, Hauptstufe, it is the pen where we kept the sacred cattle, the souls of the ancestors, all the same here, birth, soul, fire, building, male and female together. The four fins of the rocket made a cross, another mandala. Number one pointed the way it would fly, two for pitch, three for yaw and roll, four for pitch. Each opposite pair of vanes worked together and moved in opposite senses. Opposites together. You can see how we might feel it speak to us, even if we don't set one up on its fins and worship it. But it was waiting for us when we came north to Germany so long ago. Even confused and uprooted as we were then, we knew that our destiny was tied up with its own. That we had been passed over by Von Trotha's army so that we would find the aggregat.
Sothrop gives him the mandala. He hopes it will work like the mantra that Enthian told him once, Mba Kayere, I am passed over, Mba Kayere. A spell against Marvi tonight, against Ticherenye, a mezuzah, safe passage through a bad night. The Schwarzkommando have got to Achtfaden, but Ticherenye has been to Nerish. It cost him Der Springer and three enlisted men in sickbay with deep bites. One severed artery. Nerish trying to go out Audie Murphy style. A knight for a bishop. Nerish, under narco-hypnosis, raved about the Holy Circle and the rocket fin cross. But the blacks don't know what else Nerish knew. A. There was a radio link from the ground to the Escaret, but not the other way round. B. There was an interference problem between a servo actuator and a special oxygen line running aft to the device from the main tank. C. Weissmann not only coordinated the Escaret project at Nordhausen, but also commanded the battery that fired rocket 00000. Total espionage. Bit by bit, this mosaic is growing. Ticherenye, bureauless, carries it around in his brain. Every chip and scrap belongs. More precious than Ravenna, something goes erecting against the starch-colored sky. Radio link plus oxygen equal afterburner of some kind. Ordinarily it would, but Nerish also spoke of an asymmetry, a load inside near vein 3 that complicated roll and yaw control almost impossibly. Now, wouldn't an afterburner there also give an asymmetrical burning pattern and heat fluxes greater than the structure could take? Damn, why hasn't he picked up any of the propulsion people? Do the Americans have them all? Major Marvi, Bowie knife in his teeth and two Thompsons propped on either hip, as dumbfounded in the clearing as the rest of the attack party, is in no mood to talk. Instead, he is sulking and drinking vodka out of Javayev's bottomless canteen. But had any propulsion engineers assigned to the Escaret showed up at Garmisch, Marvi would have let him know. That's the arrangement. Western intelligence, Russian trigger fingers. Oh, he smells, Ensign. Even now the black may be looking in out of the night. Ticherenye lights a cigarette, green-blue lavender flare settling to yellow. He holds the flame longer than necessary, thinking, let him, he won't. I wouldn't. Well, maybe I would. But it's come a quantum jump closer tonight. They are going to meet. It will be over the Escaret, real or fantasized, working or wasted. They will meet face to face. Then. Meantime, who's the mysterious Soviet intelligence agent that Marvi talked to? Paranoia for you here, Ticherenye. Maybe Moscow's been tipped to your vendetta. If they are gathering evidence for a court-martial, it won't be any Central Asia this time. It'll be last secretary to the embassy in Atlantis.
You can negotiate narcotics arrests for all the drowned Russian sailors, expedite your own father's visas to Far Lemuria, to the sun resorts of Sargasso, where the bones come up to lie and bleach and mock the passing ships, and just before he rides out on the noon current, brochures tucked between ribs, traveler's checks wadded in a skull socket, tell him of his black sun. Tell him about the day when Ensign, in the creeping edge of autumn, cold as the mortal cold of an orange kept under shaved ice on the terrace of the hotel in Barcelona, si me quieres escribir, you already know where I'll be staying. Cold at the tip of your peeling thumb, terminally approaching cold. Listen, Marvy, by now a little drunk and peevish, when are we going to get those suckers?
It's coming, you can be sure.
But you don't know the kind of pressure I'm getting from Paris, from headquarters. It's fantastic. There's people in high places want to wipe them suckers out now. All they got to do is mash on a button. I never get to see no Mexican whores again as long as I live. Now you can see what these coons are trying to do. Somebody got to stop them before they do shit.
This intelligence man you saw, both our governments easily could have the same policy.
You ain't got General Electric breathing over your shoulder, fella. Dillon, Reed, Standard, all shit.
But that's just what you folks need. Bloody Chicklets interjects. Get some business people in there to run it right instead of having the government run everything. Your left hand doesn't know what your right hand's doing. You know that?
What's this, a political debate now? Not enough humiliation missing the Schwarzkommando. No, you didn't think you were going to get off that easy.
And what about Herbert Hoover? Chicklets is screaming. He came over and fed you people when you were starving. They love Hoover over here.
Yes, Chicherny breaks in. What is General Electric doing out here, by the way?
A friendly wink from Major Marvy. Mr. Swope was ace buddies with old FDR, you see. Electric Charlie's in there now, but Swope, he was one them brain trusters. Jews, most of them. But Swope's okay. Now GE has connections with Siemens over here. They worked on the V2 guidance, remember?
Swope's a Jew, says Chicklets.
Nah, bloody, you don't know what you're talking about.
I'm telling you, they fall into a drawling juicer's argument over the ethnic background of the ex-chairman of GE, full of poison and sluggish hate. Chicherina listens with only one ear. An episode of vertigo is creeping on him. Didn't Nerish, under the drug, mention a Siemens representative at the Escaret meetings in Nordhausen?
Yes, and an IG man, too. Didn't Carl Schmitz of the IG sit on Siemens' board of directors?
No use asking Marvy. He is too drunk by now to stay on any subject.
You know, I was pretty ignorant when I come out here. Shit, I used to think I.G. Farben was somebody's name, you know, a fella. Hello, this I.G. Farben? No, this is his wife, Mrs. Farben. Yeah, ha, ha,
Bloody Chicklets is off on his Eleanor Roosevelt routine.
The other day, my son Elliot, and I were baking cookies. Cookies to send to the boys overseas. When the boys received the cookies we sent them, they would bake cookies and send some back to us. That way, everybody gets his cookies.
Oh, Wimpy. Old V-man. Were you right? Is your IG to be the very model of nations?
So it comes to Chicherny here in the clearing with these two fools on either side of him among the debris of some numberless battery's last stand. Cables paralyzed where winch operators levered them to stillness. Beer bottles lying exactly where they were thrown by the last men on the last night. Everything testifying so purely to the shape of defeat, of operational death.
Stay there. It appears to be a very large white finger addressing him. Its fingernail is beautifully manicured as it rotates for him. It slowly reveals a fingerprint that might well be an aerial view of the city dactylic, that city of the future where every soul is known. And there is no place to hide. Right now, joints moving with soft hydraulic sounds. The finger is calling to Cherny's attention to a rocket cartel. A structure cutting across every agency, human and paper, that ever touched it. Even to Russia. Russia bought from Krupp, didn't she? From Siemens, the IG? Are there arrangements Stalin won't admit, doesn't even know about? Oh, a state begins to take form in the stateless German night. A state that spans oceans and surface politics. Sovereign as the Internationale or the Church of Rome. And the rocket is its soul. I.G. Raketen. Circus bright, poster reds and yellows, rings beyond counting, all going at once. The stately finger twirls among them all. Chicherny is certain, not so much on outward evidence he has found moving through the zone as out of a personal doom he carries with him, always to be held at the edges of revelations. It happened first with the Kyrgyz light, and his only illumination then was that fear would always keep him from going all the way in. He will never get further than the edge of this meta-cartel which has made itself known tonight, this rocket state whose borders he cannot cross. He will miss the light, but not the finger. Sadly, most sadly, everyone else seems to be in on it. Every scavenger out here is in I.G. Rakaten's employ. All except for himself and Ensign, his brother Ensign. No wonder they're after the Schwarzkommando. And when they find out I'm not what they think. And why is Marby looking at me like this now, his eyes bulging? Oh, don't panic. Don't feed his insanity. He's just this side of...
To Cuxhaven. The summer in deceleration. Floating on to Cuxhaven. The meadows hum. Rain clatters and crescent swoops through the reeds. Sheep and rarely a few dark northern deer will come down to browse for seaweed at the shore, which is never quite sea nor quite sand, but held in misty ambivalence by the sun. So Slothrop is born afloat on the water lees. Like signals set out for lost travelers, shapes keep repeating for him. Zonal shapes he will allow to enter but won't interpret, not anymore. Just as well, probably. The most persistent of these, which seem to show up at the least real times of the day, are the stair-step gables that front so many of these ancient North German buildings. Rising, backlit, a strangely wet gray as if risen out of the sea over these straight and very low horizons. They hold shape, they endure, like monuments to analysis. 300 years ago, mathematicians were learning to break the cannonball's rise and fall into stair-steps of range and height, delta X and delta Y, allowing them to grow smaller and smaller, approaching zero as armies of eternally shrinking midgets galloped upstairs and down again, the patter of their diminishing feet growing finer, smoothing out into continuous sound. This analytic legacy has been handed down intact. It brought the technicians at Peenemünde to peer at the Ascania films of rocket flights, frame by frame, delta X by delta Y, flightless themselves, film and calculus, both pornographies of flight. Reminders of impotence and abstraction, the stone Treppengiebel shapes, whole and shattered, appear now over the green plains and last a while and go away. In their shadows, children with hair like hay are playing Himmel and Hölle, jumping village pavements from heaven to hell to heaven by increments. Sometimes letting Slothrop have a turn, sometimes vanishing back into their dark gassen where elder houses, many windowed and sorrowing, bow perpetually to the neighbor across the way, nearly touching overhead, only a thin lead of milk sky between. At nightfall, the children roam the streets carrying round paper lanterns, singing Laterne, Laterne, Sonne, Mond und Sterne, spheres in country evenings, pale as souls, singing goodbye to another summer. In a coastal town near Wismar, as he's falling to sleep in a little park, they surround Slothrop and tell him the story of Plekazunga, the pig hero, who sometime back in the 10th century routed a Viking invasion, appearing suddenly out of a thunderbolt and chasing a score of screaming Norsemen back into the sea. Every summer since then, a Thursday has been set aside to celebrate the town's deliverance, Thursday being named after Donar, or Thor, the thunder god who sent down the giant pig. The old gods, even by the 10th century, still had some pull with the people. Donar hadn't quite been tamed into St. Peter or Roland, though the ceremony did come to be held at the town's Roland statue near the Peterskirche. This year, though, it's in jeopardy. Schraub, the shoemaker, who has taken the role of Plekazunga for the past 30 years, got drafted last winter into the Volksgrenadier and never came back. Now the white lanterns come crowding around Tyrone Slothrop, bobbing in the dark. Tiny fingers prod his stomach.
"You're the fattest man in the world. He's fatter than anyone in the village. Would you? Would you?" "I'm not that fat. Told you somebody would come. And taller, too. Wait a minute. Would I what? Be Plekazunga tomorrow. Please?"
Being a soft touch these days, Slothrop gives in. They roust him up out of his grass bed and down to the city hall. In the basement are costumes and props for the Schweinhildfest. Shields, spears, horned helmets, shaggy animal skins, wooden Thor's hammers and 10-foot lightning bolts covered with gold leaf.
The pig costume is a little startling. Pink, blue, yellow, bright, sour colors. A German expressionist pig, plush outside, padded with straw inside. It seems to fit perfectly. The crowd next morning is sparse and placid. Old people and children, and a few silent veterans. The Viking invaders are all kids, helmets sloping down over their eyes, capes dragging the ground, shields as big as they are, and weaponry twice as high. Giant Flekkasunga images with white stock and red and blue cornflowers woven onto the wire mesh frames line the square. Flothrop waits, hidden behind the Roland, a particularly humorless, goggle-eyed, curly-headed, pinch-waisted specimen. With Slothrop is an arsenal of fireworks and his assistant, Fritz, who's about 8, and a Wilhelm Busch original. Slothrop is a little nervous, unaccustomed as he is to pig hero festivals, but Fritz is an old hand, and has thoughtfully brought along a glazed jug of some liquid brain damage, flavored with dill and coriander, and distilled, unless Haferschleim means something else, from oatmeal. Haferschleim, Fritz? He takes another belt. Sorry, he asked. Haferschleim, ja. Well, Haferschleim is better than none. Ho, ho. Whatever it is, it seems to work swiftly on the nerve centers. By the time all the Vikings, to a solemn brass chorale from the local band, have puffed and struggled up to the statue, formed ranks, and demanded the town's surrender, Slothrop finds his brain working with less than the usual keenness. At which point, Fritz strikes his match, and all hell breaks loose. Rockets, Roman candles, pinwheels, and Plechazunga! An enormous charge of black powder blasts him out in the open, singeing his ass, taking the curl right out of his tail. Oh, yes, that's right. Wobbling, grinning hugely, Slothrop hollers his line, I am the wrath of Donar, and this day you shall be my anvil. Away they all go in a good roaring chase through the streets, in a shower of white blossoms, little kids squealing down to the water, where everybody starts splashing and ducking everybody else. Townspeople break out beer, wine, bread, quark, sausages. Gold-brown Kartoffelpuffer are lifted, dripping hot from oil smoking in black skillets over little peat fires. Girls commence stroking Slothrop's snout and velvet flanks. The town is saved for another year. A peaceful, drunken day, full of music, the smell of salt water, marsh flowers, frying onions, spilled beer and fresh fish, overhead little frost-colored clouds blowing along the blue sky. The breeze is cool enough to keep Slothrop from sweating inside this pig suit. All along the shoreline, blue-gray woods breathe and shimmer. White sails move out in the sea. Slothrop returns from the brown back room of a pipe smoke and cabbage cafe and an hour's game of hammer and forge with every boy's dream, two healthy young ladies in summer dresses and wood-soled shoes to find the crowd begun to coagulate into clumps of 3 and 4. Oh, shit. Not now. Come on. Tight aching across his asshole, head and stomach inflated with oat mash and summer beer, Slothrop sits on a pile of nets and tries, fat chance, to will himself alert. These little vortices appearing in a crowd out here usually mean black market. Weeds of paranoia begin to bloom, army green among the garden and midday tranquillities. Last of his line, and how far fallen, no other Slothrop ever felt such fear in the presence of commerce. Newspapers already lie spread out on the cobbles for buyers to dump out cans of coffee on, make sure it's all Bonen Café, and not just a thin layer on top of ersatz. Gold watches and rings appear abruptly sunlit out of dusty pockets. Cigarettes go flashing hand to hand among the limp and filthy and soundless Reichsmarks. Kids play underfoot while the grown-ups deal in Polish, Russian, North Baltic, Plattdeutsch. Some of the DP style here, a little impersonal, just passing through, dealing en route, in motion, almost as an afterthought. Where'd they all come from, these gray hustlers? What shadows in the Gemütlichkeit of the day were harboring them? Materializing from their own weird office silence, the coppers show up now, two black-and-white sharabangs full of blue-green uniforms, white armbands, little bucket hats with starburst insignia, truncheons already unsheathed, black dildos in nervous hands, wobbling, ready for action. The eddies in the crowd break up fast, jewelry ringing to the pavement, cigarettes scattered and squashed under the feet of stampeding civilians, among the instant litter of watches, war medals, silk stuffs, rolls of bills,
pink-skinned potatoes, all their eyes staring in alarm, elbow-length kid gloves twisted up, fingers clutching at sky, smashed light bulbs, Parisian slippers, gold picture frames around still lifes of cobbles, rings, brooches. Nobody gonna claim any of it. Everybody's scared now. No wonder. The cops go at busting these proceedings the way they must have handled anti-Nazi street actions before the war. Moving in, with these flexible clubs, eyes tuned to the finest possibilities of threat, smelling of leather, of the wool armpit rankness of their own fear, jumping little kids 3-on-1, shaking down girls, old people, making them take off and shake out even boots and underwear, jabbing and battering in with tireless truncheon work among the crying kids and screaming women. Beneath the efficiency and glee is nostalgia for the old days. The war must have been lean times for crowd control. Murder and mopery was the best you could do, one suspect at a time. But now, with the white market to be protected, here again are whole streets full of bodies eager for that erste Abreibung, and you can bet the heat are happy with it. Presently they have Russian reinforcements, 3 truckloads of young Asiatics in fatigues, who don't seem to know where they are exactly, just shipped in from someplace very cold and far to the east. Out of their slat-sided rigs, like soccer players coming on field, they form a line and start to clear the street by compressing the crowd toward the water. Slothrop is right in the middle of all this, shoved stumbling backward, pig mask cutting off half his vision, trying to shield whom he can, a few kids, an old lady who was busy earlier moving cotton yardage. The first billy clubs catch him in the straw padding over his stomach and don't feel like much. Civilians are going down right and left, but Plekazunga is holding his own. Has the morning been only a dress rehearsal? Is Slothrop expected to repel real foreign invaders now? The tiny girl is clutching to his leg, crying the Schweinheld's name in a confident voice. A grizzled old cop, years of home front, high living and bribes in his face, comes swinging a club at Slothrop's head. The swine hero dodges and kicks with his free leg. As the cop doubles over, half a dozen yelling civilians jump on, relieving him of hat and truncheon. Tears caught by the sun leak out of his withered eyes. Then gunfire has started somewhere, panicking everybody, carrying Slothrop half off his feet, the kid around his leg torn loose and lost in the rush forever. Out of the street, onto the quay. The police have quit hitting people and begun picking up loot off of the street. But now the Russians are moving in, and enough of them are looking straight at Slothrop. Providentially, one of the girls from the cafe shows up about now, takes his hand and tugs him along. There's a warrant out for you. A what? They're doing pretty good without any paperwork. The Russians found your uniform. They think you're a deserter. They're right. She takes Slothrop home with her in his pig suit. He never hears her name. She is about 17, fair, a young face, easy to hurt. They lie behind a sperm-yellowed bedsheet, tacked to the ceiling, very close on a narrow bed with lacquered posts. Her mother is carving turnips in the kitchen. Their two hearts pound, his for his danger, hers for Slothrop. She tells how her parents lived, her father a printer, married during his journeymanship. His wonder years now stretched out to 10, no word where he's been since 42, when they had a note from Neukölln where he had dossed down the night with a friend. Always a friend, God knows how many back rooms, roundhouses, print shops he slept single nights in, shivering, wrapped in back numbers of Die Welt am Montag, sure of at least shelter. Like everybody in the Buchdrucherverband, often a meal, almost certainly some kind of police trouble if the stay lasted too long. It was a good union. They kept the German wobbly traditions. They didn't go along with Hitler, though all the other unions were falling into line. It touches Slothrop's own Puritan hopes for the word. The word made printer's ink, dwelling along with antibodies and iron-bound breath in a good man's blood, though the world for him be always the world on Monday, with its cold cutting edge, slicing away every poor illusion of comfort the bourgeois takes for real. Did he run off leaflets against his country's insanity? Was he busted, beaten, killed? She has a snapshot of him on holiday, someplace Bavarian, waterfalled, white-peaked, a tanned and ageless face, Tyrolean hat, galluses, feet planted, perpetually set to break into a run. The image stopped, preserved here, the only way they could keep him, running room to room down all his cold red suburbs, Freemasons night to night. Their aproned and kitchen way of going evening or empty afternoon in to study the Delta X's and Delta Y's of his drifter's spirit, on the run, study how he was changing inside the knife fall of the shutter, what he might have been hearing in the water,
flowing like himself forever in lost silence behind him, already behind him. Even now, lying beside a stranger in a pig disguise, her father is the flying element of Slothrop, of whoever else has lain here before, flightless, and heard the same promise, I'd go anywhere with you. He sees them walking a railroad trestle, pines on long slanted mountains all around, autumn sunlight and cold purple rain clouds, mid-afternoon, her face against some tall concrete structure, the light of the concrete coming down oblique both sides of her cheekbones, blending into her skin, blending with its own light. Her motionless figure above him in a black greatcoat, blonde hair against the sky, himself at the top of a metal ladder in a train yard, gazing up at her, all their shining steel roads below crisscrossing and peeling off to all parts of the zone. Both of them on the run. That's what she wants. But Slothrop only wants to lie still with her heartbeat a while. Isn't that every paranoid's wish? To perfect methods of immobility. But they're coming house to house looking for their deserter, and it's Slothrop who has to go, she who has to stay. In the streets, loudspeakers, buzzing metal throats, are proclaiming an early curfew tonight. Through some window of the town, lying in some bed, already browsing at the edges of the fields of sleep, is a kid for whom the metal voice with its foreign accent is a sign of nightly security, to be part of the wild fields, the rain on the sea, dogs, smells of cooking from strange windows, dirt roads, part of this unrecoverable summer. There's no moon, she whispers, her eyes flinching but not looking away. What's the best way out of town? She knows 100. His heart, his fingertips hurt with shame. I'll show you. You don't have to. I want to. Her mother gives Slothrop a couple of hard rolls to stash inside his pig suit. She'd find him something else to wear, but all her husband's clothes have been traded for food at the Tauschzentrale. His last picture of her is framed in the light of her kitchen. Through the window, a fading golden woman, head in a nod over a stove with a single pot simmering, flowered wallpaper deep orange and red behind her averted face. The daughter leads him over low stone walls, along drainage ditches and into culverts, southwesterly to the outskirts of the town. Far behind them, the clock in the Peterskirche strikes 9, the sightless Roland below continuing to gaze across the square. White flowers fall one by one from the images of Plechazunga. Stacks of a power station rise, ghostly, smokeless, painted on the sky. A windmill creaks out in the countryside. The city gate is high and skinny, with stair steps to nowhere on top. The road away goes curving through the ogival opening out into the night meadows. I want to go with you. But she makes no move to step through the arch with him. Maybe I'll be back. It's no drifter's lie. Both of them are sure that someone will be, next year at about this time, maybe next year's Schweinheld, someone close enough. And if the name, the dossier are not exactly the same, well, who believes in those? She's a printer's kid. She knows the medium. She even learned from him how to handle a Winkelhaken pretty good, how to set up a line and take it down. You're a Maybug, she whispers, and kisses him goodbye, and stands watching him go, a sniffling, still girl in pinafore and army boots by the isolated gate. Good night, docile girl. Good night. What does he have for her but a last snapshot of a trudging pig in motley, merging with the stars and wood piles, something to put beside that childhood still of her father? He impersonates flight, though his heart isn't in it, and yet he's lost all knowledge of staying. Good night, it's curfew. Get back inside, back in your room. Good night. He keeps to open country, sleeping when he's too tired to walk, straw and velvet insulating him from the cold. One morning he wakes in a hollow between a stand of beech and a stream, this sunrise and bitter cold, and there seems to be a warm tongue licking roughly at his face. He is looking here into the snout of another pig, very fat and pink pig. He grunts and smiles amiably, blinking long eyelashes. Wait, how about this? He puts on the pig mask. She stares for a minute, then moves up to Slothrop and kisses him snout to snout. End of side 18. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.
Side 19. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 668. Both of them are dripping with dew. He follows her on down to the stream, takes off the mask again, and throws water at his face while she drinks beside him, slurping, placid. The water is clear, running lively, cold. Round rocks knock together under the stream, a resonant sound, a music. It would be worth something to sit day and night in and out, listening to these sounds of water and cobbles unfold. Slothrop is hungry. Come on, we gotta find breakfast. Beside a small pond near a farmhouse, the pig discovers a wood stake driven into the ground. She begins snuffling around it. Slothrop kicks aside loose earth and finds a brick cairn stuffed with potatoes and siled last year. Fine for you, as she falls too eagerly, but I can't eat that stuff. Sky is shining in the calm surface of the water. Nobody seems to be around. Slothrop wanders off to check the farmhouse. Tall white daisies grow all over the yard. Thatch-hooded windows upstairs are dark. No smoke comes from the chimneys. But the chicken house in back is occupied. He eases a big, fat white hen up off of her nest, reaches gingerly for the eggs. Pecaw! She flies into a dither, tries to peck Slothrop's arm off. Friends come shooting in from outside, raising a god-awful commotion, at which point the hen has worked her wings through the wood slats so she can't get back in and is too fat below the wing pits to get the rest of the way out. So, there she hangs, flapping and screaming, while Slothrop grabs three eggs, then tries to push her wings back inside for her. It is a frustrating job, especially trying to keep the eggs balanced. The rooster is in the doorway, hollering, Achtung! Achtung! Discipline in his harem is shot to hell. Noisy white tumbleweed hens are barrel-assing all over the inside of the coop, and blood is flowing from Slothrop in half a dozen places. Then he hears a dog barking. Time to give up on this hen. Comes outside, sees a lady in her Wehrmacht auxiliary outfit 30 meters away leveling a shotgun, and the dog charging in, growling, teeth bared, eyes on Slothrop's throat. Slothrop goes scrambling around the henhouse just as the gun kicks off a good morning blast. About then, the pig shows up and chases off the dog. Away they go, eggs cradled in pig mask, lady yelling, hens raising hell, pig galloping along beside. There's a final shotgun blast, but by then, they're out of range. About a mile farther on, they pause for Slothrop's breakfast. Good show, thumping the pig affectionately. She crouches, catching her breath, gazing at him while he eats raw eggs and smokes half a cigarette. Then they set off again. Soon they have begun to angle toward the sea. The pig seems to know where she's going. Far away on another road, a great cloud of dust hangs, crawling southward, maybe a Russian horse convoy. Fledgling storks are trying out their wings over the haystacks and fields. Tops of solitary trees are blurred green, as if smudged accidentally by a sleeve. Brown windmills turn at the horizon, across miles of straw-sprinkled red earth. A pig is a jolly companion, boar, sow, barrow, or gilt. A pig is a pal who'll boost your morale, though mountains may topple and tilt. When they've blackballed, bamboozled, and burned you, when they've turned on you Taurian wig, though you may be thrown over by tabby or rover, you'll never go wrong with a pig. A pig, you'll never go wrong with a pig. By nightfall, they have entered a wooded stretch. Fog drifts in the hollows. A lost, unmilked cow complains somewhere in the darkness. The pig and Slothrop settled down to sleep among pines thick with shreds of tinfoil, a cloud of British window dumped to fox the German radars in some long-ago raid, a whole forest of Christmas trees, tinsel rippling in the wind, catching the starlight, silent, ice-cold crown fire, acres wild over their heads all night. Slothrop keeps waking to find a pig snuggled in a bed of pine needles, watching over him. It's not for danger, or out of restlessness. Maybe she's decided Slothrop needs looking after. In the tinfoil light, she's very sleek and convex. Her bristles look smooth as down. Lustful thoughts come filtering into Slothrop's mind. Little peculiarity here, you know. Nothing he can't handle. They fall asleep under the decorated trees. The pig a wandering eastern magus. Slothrop in his costume a gaudy present waiting for morning and a child to claim him. Next day, about noon, they enter a slow-withering city alone on the Baltic coast and perishing from an absence of children. The sign over the city gate in burned bulbs and empty sockets reads, Zwölfkinder. The great wheel dominating the skyline for miles out of town leans a little askew. Grim old governess, sun catching long streaks of rust, sky pale through the iron lattice that droops its long twisted shadow across the sand and into the plum sea. Wind cat howls in and out the doorless halls and houses.
Frida?
A voice calling from the blue shadow behind a wall. Grunting, smiling, the pig stands her ground. Look who I brought home. Soon a thin, freckled man, blonde, nearly bald, steps out into the sun. Glancing at Slothrop, nervous, he reaches to scratch Frida between the ears.
I am Perkler. Thank you for bringing her back.
No, no, she brought me.
Yes.
Perkler is living in the basement of the town hall. He has some coffee heating on a driftwood fire in the stove.
Do you play chess?
Frida kibitzes. Slothrop, who tends to play more by superstition than strategy, is obsessed with protecting his knights, springer and springer, willing to lose anything else, thinking no more than a move or two ahead, if that. He alternates long, lethargic backing and filling with bursts of idiot razzle-dazzle that have Perkler frowning, but not with worry. About the time Slothrop loses his queen...
Say, wait a minute. Did you say Perkler?
Zip, the man is out with a luger as big as a house. Really fast guy, with the muzzle pointing right at Slothrop's head. For a moment, Slothrop, in his pig suit, thinks that Perkler thinks that he, Slothrop, has been fooling around with Frida the pig, and that there is about to be a shotgun or luger wedding here. In fact, the phrase, "Unto thee I pledge my troth," has just arrived in his brain when he realizes that what Perkler is actually saying is, "You'd better leave. Only two more moves, and I'd have had you anyway." "Let me at least tell you my story," slithering fast as he can the Zurich information with Perkler's name on it, the Russian-American Herrero search for the Escaret. Wondering, meantime, in parallel, sort of, if that Oberst-Enzian wasn't right about going native in the zone. Beginning to get ideas fixed and slightly, erotic notions about destiny. Are you, Slothrop? Eh? Tracing back the route Frida the pig brought him along, trying to remember forks where they might have turned another way.
The Schwarzgerät. Perkler shakes his head. I don't know what it was.
I was never that interested. Is that really all you're after?
Slothrop thinks that over. Their coffee cups take sunlight from the window and bounce it back up to the ceiling, bobbing ellipses of blue light.
Don't know, except for this kind of personal tie-in with Emipolex G.
It's an aromatic polyamide, Perkler putting the gun back in his shirt.
Tell me about it, says Slothrop.
Well, but not before he has told something of his Ilse and her summer returns, enough for Slothrop to be taken again by the nape and pushed against Bianca's dead flesh. Ilse, fathered on Greta Erdmann's silver and passive image, Bianca conceived during the filming of the very scene that was in his thoughts as Perkler pumped in the fatal charge of sperm. How could they not be the same child? She's still with you, though harder to see these days, nearly invisible as a glass of gray lemonade in a twilight room. Still she is there, cool and acid and sweet, waiting to be swallowed down to touch your deepest cells. To work among your saddest dreams. Perkler does manage to tell a little about Laszlo Jampf, but keeps getting sidetracked off into talking about the movies, German movies Slothrop has never heard of, much less seen. Yes, he is some kind of fanatical movie hound, all right. On D-Day, he confesses, when I heard General Eisenhower on the radio announcing the invasion of Normandy, I thought it was really Clark Gable. Have you ever noticed the voices are identical? In the last third of his life, there came over Laszlo Jampf, so it seemed to those who from out in the wood lecture halls watched his eyelids slowly granulate, spots and wrinkles grow across his image, disintegrating it toward old age, a hostility, a strangely personal hatred for the covalent bond. A conviction that, for synthetics to have a future at all, the bond must be improved on. Some students even read transcended. That something so mutable, so soft, as a sharing of electrons by atoms of carbon should lie at the core of life, his life, struck Jampf as a cosmic humiliation. Sharing? How much stronger, how everlasting was the ionic bond where electrons are not shared but captured, seized, and held, polarized, plus and minus, these atoms, no ambiguities. How he came to love that clarity, how stable it was, such mineral stubbornness. Whatever lip service we may pay to reason, he told Perkler's class back at the TH, to moderation and compromise, nevertheless there remains the lion, a lion in each one of you. He is either tamed by too much mathematics, by details of design, by corporate procedures, or he stays wild, an eternal predator. The lion does not know subtleties and half solutions. He does not accept sharing as a basis for anything. He takes, he holds. He is not a Bolshevik or a Jew. You will never hear relativity from the lion. He wants the absolute life and death, win and lose. Not truces or arrangements, but the joy of the leap, the roar of the blood. If this be National Socialist chemistry, blame that something in the air, the Zeitgeist. Sure, blame it. Professor Dr. Jampf was not immune, neither was his student Pöckler. But through inflation and depression, Pöckler's idea of the lion came to have a human face attached to it, a movie face, natürlich, that of the actor Rudolf Kleinroge, whom Pöckler idolized and wanted to be like. Kleinroge was carrying nubile actresses off to rooftops when King Kong was still on the tit, with no motor skills to speak of. Well, one nubile actress anyway, Brigitte Helm in Metropolis. Great movie. Exactly the world Pöckler and evidently quite a few others were dreaming about those days, a corporate city-state, where technology was the source of power. The engineer worked closely with the administrator, the masses labored unseen, far underground, and ultimate power lay with a single leader at the top, fatherly and benevolent and just, who wore magnificent-looking suits and whose name Pöckler couldn't remember, being too taken with Kleinroge playing the mad inventor that Pöckler and his co-disciples under Jampf longed to be, indispensable to those who ran the metropolis, yet at the end, the untamable lion, who could let it all crash. Girl, state, masses, himself, asserting his reality against them all in one last roaring plunge from rooftop to street. A curious potency. Whatever it was the real visionaries were picking up out of the hard tessitura of those days in city streets, whatever Käthe Kollwitz saw that brought her lean death down to hump its women from behind, and they to love it so, seemed now and then to have touched Pöckler too, in his deeper excursions into the Mare Nocturnum. He found delight not unlike a razor sweeping his skin and nerves, scalp to soles, in ritual submissions to the master of this night space and of himself, the male embodiment of a technologique that embraced power not for its social uses, but for just those chances of surrender, personal and dark surrender to the void, to delicious and screaming collapse. To Attila the Hun, as a matter of fact, come west out of the steppes to smash the precious structure of magic and incest that held together the kingdom of the Burgundians. Pöckler was tired that night, all day out scavenging for coal. He kept falling asleep, waking to images that for half a minute he could make no sense of at all. A close-up of a face, a forest, the scales of the dragon, a battle scene. Often enough, it would resolve into Rudolf Kleinroge, ancient oriental thanatomaniac Attila, head shaved except for a topknot, bead strung, raving with grandiloquent gestures and those enormous bleak eyes. Pöckler would nod back into sleep with bursts of destroying beauty there for his dreams to work on, speaking barbaric gutturals for the silent mouths, smoothing the Burgundians into something of the meekness, the grayness of certain crowds in the beer halls back at the TH. And wake again, it went on for hours, into some further progression of carnage, of fire and smashing. On the way home, by tram and foot, his wife bitched at Pöckler for dozing off, ridiculed his engineer's devotion to cause and effect. How could he tell her that the dramatic connections were really all there in his dreams? How could he tell her anything? Kleinroge is remembered most of all for his role as Dr. Mabuse. You were meant to think of Ugo Stinnes, the tireless operator behind the scenes of apparent inflation, apparent history, gambler, financial wizard, arch-gangster, a fuzzy burgerlich mouth, jowls, graceless moves, the first impression of comic technocracy. And yet, when the rages came over him, breaking through from beneath the rationalized look with his glacial eyes become windows into the bare savanna, then the real Mabuse surfaced, vital and proud against the gray forces surrounding him, edging him toward the doom he must have known he couldn't escape, the silent inferno of guns, grenades, streets full of troops attacking his headquarters, and his own madness at the end of the secret tunnel. And who brought him down but matinee idol Bernhard Goetzke, estate prosecutor von Wenck, Goetzke who played tender, wistful, bureaucratic death in Der Müde Tod, here too running true to form, too tame, too gentle for the jaded countess he coveted. But Kleinroge jumped in, with all claws out, drove her effeminate husband to suicide, seized her, threw her on his bed, the languid bitch, took her, while gentle Gutzke sat in his office, among his papers and sybarites, Mabuza trying to hypnotize him, drug him, bomb him to death in his own office. Nothing worked. Each time the great Weimar inertia, files, hierarchies, routines, kept saving him. Mabuza was the savage throwback, the charismatic flash no Sunday afternoon aqua plate could ever bear. The print through the rippling solution, each time flaring up to the same annihilating white. Piscean depths, Berkler has cruised, dream and waking, beneath him images of everyday inflation, dreariness, queues, stockbrokers, boiled potatoes in a dish, searching with only gills and gut, some nervous drive toward myth he doesn't even know if he believes in, for the white light, ruins of Atlantis, intimations of a truer kingdom. Metropolitan inventor Rotwang, King Attila, Mabuza, Der Spieler, Professor Dr. Laszlo Jamf, all their yearnings aimed the same way, toward a form of death that could be demonstrated to hold joy and defiance. Nothing of bourgeois Goetzkian death, of self-deluding, mature acceptance, relatives in the parlor, knowing faces the children can always read. "You have the two choices," Jamf cried, his last lecture of the year. Outside were the flowery strokings of wind, girls in pale-colored dresses, oceans of beer, male choruses intensely, movingly lifted as they sang, "Semper sit in flores, semper sit in flores. Stay behind with carbon and hydrogen. Take your lunch bucket into the works every morning with the faceless droves who can't wait to get in out of the sunlight or move beyond. Silicon, boron, phosphorus, these can replace carbon and can bond to nitrogen instead of hydrogen." A few snickers here, not unanticipated by the playful old pedagogue, be he always in flower. His involvement in getting Weimar to subsidize the IG's Stickstoff Syndikat was well known. Move beyond life, toward the inorganic. Here is no frailty, no mortality. Here is strength and the timeless. Then his well-known finale, as he wiped away the scrawled C-H on his chalkboard and wrote in enormous letters, S-I-N. The wave of the future. But Jamf himself, oddly, did not move on. He never synthesized those new inorganic rings or chains he had prophesied so dramatically. Had he only remained behind in the trough, academic generations swelling away just ahead, or had he known something Perkler and the others didn't? Were his exhortations in the lecture hall some kind of eccentric joke? He stayed with C-H and took his lunch bucket to America. Perkler lost touch with him after the Technische Hochschule. So did all his old pupils. He was now under the sinister influence of Lyle Bland, and if he was still seeking to escape the mortality of the covalent bond, Jamf was doing it in the least obvious way there was. If that Lyle Bland hadn't joined the Masons, he'd still probably be up to those nefarious tricks of his. Just as there are in the world machineries committed to injustice as an enterprise, so too there seem to be provisions active for balancing things out once in a while. Not as an enterprise exactly, but at least in the dance of things. The Masons, in the dance of things, turned out to be one of these where Bland was concerned. Imagine the fellow's plight. Got so much money, he don't know what to do with it all. Don't go screaming, give it to me either. He's given it to you, though in roundabout ways you might need a good system of search to unsnarl. Oh, has he given it to you by way of the Bland Institute and the Bland Foundation? The man has had his meat hooks well into the American day-to-day since 1919. Who do you think sat on top of the patent for that 100 miles per gallon carburetor, eh? Sure, you've heard that story. Maybe even snickered along with paid anthropologists who called it automotive age myth or some shit. Well, turns out the item was real, all right. And it was Lyle Bland who sprang for those academic hookers doing the snickering and the credentialed lying. Or how about the great killer weed advertising campaign of the 30s? Who do you think worked hand in glove, or as grosser individuals have put it, penis in mouth, with the FBI on that one? And remember all those guy goes to the doctor, can't get a hard-on jokes? planted by Bland. Yep, half a dozen basic variations after having done depth studies for the National Research Council that indicated an unacceptable 36% of the male workforce wasn't paying enough attention to their cocks. Not enough genital obsession there. And it was undermining the efficiency of the organs doing the real work. Psychological studies became, in fact, a Bland specialty. His probe into the subconscious of early depression America is considered a classic and widely credited with improving the plausibility of Roosevelt's election in 1932. Though many of his colleagues found a posture of hatred for FDR useful, Bland was too delighted